Maxine Kuman is a poet, novelist, writer of children's books, essayist, and teacher. She is the consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress. Her books of poems are The Retrieval System, House, Bridge, Fountain, Gate, Up Country, which was the 1973 Pulitzer Prize winner, The Nightmare Factory, The Privilege, and Halfway. The most recent of her four novels is The Designated Heir. She has taught at the Breadloaf Writers Conference, at Columbia University, Brandeis University, and Princeton University. Her other honors include an American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters Award, first prize in the 1976 Boarstone Mountain Awards, and a National Council on the Arts Fellowship. Maxine Kuman.
Shaking her chignon, suck you must not, or the tailor will chop. And here is smart Robert, the flying boy, bad one. Whee, how the storm blows and coughs in the treetops. Mama has told him today he must stay in, but Robert slips out with umbrella and rain cap. Now he is flying. The wind sucks and pulls him. See, he is carried up smaller and smaller. His cap flies ahead of him. No one can help him. Therefore, says Fräulein, smoothing her collar, mind me, says Fräulein, God stands up in heaven. See how he watches? He snatches the bad ones. Well, thus emboldened, I'd like to read another very early poem. That poem is from my first book, Halfway, which Holt Reinhardt and Winston published in 1961. And in the way of first commercial poetry books, printed 1,000 copies, sold 300, shredded the other 700, and we then moved on. But here's another early poem. This is, I guess, my World War II love poem. It's called Casablanca. It's, of course, based on the film of the same name. But if you missed Casablanca on the Late Late Show, maybe you have seen Play It Again, Sam, so that you pretty much know the plot of the old movie. Casablanca. As years unwind, now reels unwind, gray springs out of the hair, cheeks refill and eyelids lighten. Bogey, beautifully indifferent, seduces a cigarette and womankind. Ingrid, in perilous rain intensified by angle shots, is Juno fair and fair. When France falls and gates clang shut, she faithfully misses the final train. Now Vichy is dead, and Peter Lorre less cowardly, and Green Street has gone with the parrot, and I knew a boy with sandy hair could do the dialogue all blurry, cigarette dangling, cheeks sucked hollow, hands in his jacket pockets, could do the dialogue for drinks at any party, went down with his destroyer, swallowed in the other half of that real war. The tough guy, lately dead of cancer, holds the girl, and then they kiss for the last time, and time goes west, and we come back to where we really are. Now, I thought maybe I would just sort of skip around thematically, because it is said, and I think with some truth, that the poet has one song and sings it over and over. With that in mind, I thought I might read the title poem from The Retrieval System and then jump off from that into some other poems. And you'll see what the linkage is with the Casablanca poem. The Weathered Goat, this is W-E-T-H-E-R-E-D. It's a castrated goat. Goats are very commonly kept as pasture pets for horses. They get on very well together, the two species. And this particular goat used to run under the belly of a large Palomino gelding I had, large meaning fat Palomino gelding I had once, and I used to wince every time I saw him do it because he had elaborate horns, and the clearance was extremely tight, but somehow or other he never did manage to scrape Jupiter. The retrieval system. It begins with my dog, now dead, who all his long life carried about in his head the brown eyes of my father. Keen, loving, accepting, sorrowful, whatever, they were daddy's all right, handed on, except for their phosphorescent gleam tunneling the night, which I have to concede was a separate gift. Uncannily, when I'm alone, these features come up to link my lost people with the patient domestic beasts of my life. For example, the weathered goat who runs free in pasture and stable with his flecked agate eyes and his minus sign pupils blats in the tiny voice of my former piano teacher, whose bones beat time in my dreams and whose terrible breath soured country gardens, humoresque and unplayable Bach. My elderly aunts, wearing the heads of willful, intelligent ponies, stand at the fence begging apples. The sister who died at 3 has my cat's faint chin, my cat's inscrutable squint, and cried cat-like in pain. I remember the funeral. The Lord is my shepherd, we said. I don't want to brood. Fact, it is people who fade. It is animals that retrieve them. A boy I loved once keeps coming back as my yearling colt, cocksure at the gallop, racing his shadow for the hell of it. He runs merely to be. A boy who was lost in the war 30 years ago and buried at sea. Here it's 40 degrees and raining. The weatherman, who looks like my resident owl, the one who goes out and in by the open haymow, appears on the TV screen. With his heart-shaped face, he is also my late dentist's double, donnish, bifocal, kind, going a little gray, advising this wisdom tooth will have to come out someday, meanwhile filling it as a favor, another save. It outlasted him. The forecast is nothing but trouble. It will snow fiercely enough to fill all these open graves. Now I'm going to do sort of what I said and go back. We may as well start with the dog. The Upcountry book opens with a series of, it's the hermit poems, and there are 8 of them. All written in the same male persona. And I must say now, from this vantage point of some years after, that really the only reason I think I wrote them in a male persona was that I didn't think the world was ready to take a female hermit seriously enough. The hermit in each case is me. Or should I say the hermit in each case is I. And this one is called The Hermit Meets the Skunk. The hermit's dog skitters home drunk with it once every fall, the whites of his eyes marbled from the spray, and his tail tucked tighter than a clamshell. He contracts himself to a mouse under the hermit's bed. The hermit unsticks him with a broom and ties him outside to a tree. He is a spotted dog, black rampant on white, and as the hermit scrubs, the white goes satiny with lava soap. The black brightens to a bootblack shine. Next, a dose of tomato juice stains the white like a razor cut underwater and purples the black. And after that, the whole dog bleaches moon-colored under a drench of cornstarch. The hermit sniffs him. Skunk is still plain as a train announcement. So he is to be washed again, rinsed again, powdered again, until the spots wink out again, under the neutral white. Inside his mouth, the hermit knows, and knows from what is visible under the tail, dog is equally spotted, but in the interior, gray on a pink field. If he were to be pinned down, his four legs held at four corners and slit open by the enthusiast, the hermit knows the true nature of dog, spotted layer by layer, would be laid bare. Afterward, all night, skunk sleepwalks the house. Skunk is a pot of copper pennies, scorched dry on a high flame. Skunk is a porridge of dead shrews, stewed down to gelatin. Skunk is the bloat of chicken gut, left 10 days to sweeten in the sun. Skunk is the mother bed, the ripe taste of carrion, the green kiss. Well, there's the dog in one instance. Here's a little poem about that same dog. It's a dream poem called Making the Connection. Looking for good news to skate out with over the ice pond of sleep, I'm tricked instead to think I hear him whimpering in the kitchen. His ghost comes on metal toenails, scratches himself, the thump of thigh bone on linoleum. Ghost laps water, whines. Soon he will howl in the prison of his deafness, that paranoid, strangled sound waking the grown children who all live elsewhere. I sit up, breaking the connection, like hanging up on my brother. I am 10. I go down terrified past a house full of bubbling breathers, unlatch the cellar door, go further down in darkness to lie on old carpet next to the incontinent puppy. His heartbeat, my heartbeat comfort us, and the fluttering pulse of the furnace starting up, stopping, and the vague percussion of pipes that buzz in the far corner. Brother, brother dog, is that who you were? Is that who I was? Well, bear with me. This is a sort of a new experiment. I even have a goat poem, so I think maybe I'll try reading that. This is a very kind of nostalgic pastoral poem, and it's just called Caught. Late August, the goats keep leaving Eden. Identical twin Toggenbergs, they swim to freedom, climb tree stumps, maybe they fly. While I boil my hands red, skinning beets, their collar bells sound distant telephones. Intercepting the call, I go with grain to rattle in a coffee can. One has got an ancient pea vine in her mouth. The other trails a plate-sized bloom of squash. When they circle me, wary but gluttonous, I pounce, snaring one which flops like a great warm fish against my breast, then stiffens, then goes limp. I carry her off to her fenced half-acre. Meanwhile, the other, perfectly cloned, trots at my side and interjects staccato sounds of displeasure at not being carried, at the genetic misfortune of having to duplicate her sister's act. They give me a Bronx cheer send-off, scoot to the top of the boulder ridge long hidden in raspberry cane, now eaten clean, and forget for a day or two how they came out in the world. Late August, truce this instant with what's to come. Everything caught, this moment caught. My horse at the paddock fence making that soft, ingratiating knicker that asks for supper. No older and no riper than was planned, the sun staining the west, my matching hands. Oh, we have now covered the dog and the goat, and I guess the next thing we have to cover are the aunts. Housebridge Fountain Gate has a series of Amanda poems, which are horse poems. And I'll read a couple of those. And the first one I'll read will be the one that refers to the maiden aunts. It's called Brushing the Aunts. In New England, they say aunt. It may sound very strange to you here, but an ant is a little insect. Consider Amanda, my sensible strawberry roan, her face with its broad white blaze lending an air of constant surprise, homely Amanda, colossal and mild. She evokes those good ghosts of my childhood, brillo-haired and big-boned, the freckled maiden aunts. Though barren like her, they were not petulant. Peaceable dears, they lay down alone, mute as giraffes in my mother's house, fed tramps on the back porch after the crash, pantomimed the Charleston summer nights in the upstairs back bedroom, and dropped apple peels over their shoulders to spell the name of a marrying man. Remembering this, I bring Amanda windfalls that season again. The power of the leaf runs the human brain, raising the dead like lamb clouds in the sky. The power of the thorn holds the bird's late nests, now strung like laundry from the blackberry canes, where parts of Amanda recur. Her body fuzz is stickered in the oriole cups. Copper hairs from her tail hang the packages up. All fall as I drop to the scalp of sleep, while the raccoons whistle and the geese cough, and Amanda grows small in my head, the powder streak of her face a blur 70 pastures off. The aunts return, letting down their hair. It hangs to the custard of Harriet's lap. It tickles the spine of Alma's girdle, and the dream unwinds like a top. In 4/4 time, the way it was once, I am brushing the carrot frizz gone gray, 100 ritual strokes one way, 100 ritual strokes the other. We dance the old back bedroom dance that rattles the shakes of my mother's house, till Amanda jitters, yanking her tether, her eyes green holes in the dark, her blaze a slice of moon looming at the gate, and the latch flies up on another night. Now, I understand that there was a request for The Agnostic Speaks to Her Horse's Hoof, so I will read that. And I'll just gloss the word frog in the first line in case horses are not your thing. You might not know that it refers to the soft underportion of the hoof and not to the inhabitant of the pond. The agnostic speaks to her horse's hoof. Come, frog, reveal yourself. Surface out of the poultice, the muck and manure pack. Make your miraculous V to stand up. Show me as well the tickle place, that cleft between. The good book says a man's life is as grass the wind passes over and is gone. According to the National Geographic, the oceans will lie down dead as cesspools in 60 years. Let us ripen in our own way. I, with my back to the trunk of a butternut that has caught the fatal red canker, and on my knee this skillet of your old foot. The hoof pick is God's instrument, as much as I know of him. In my hands let it raise your moon, Amanda, your nerve bone. Let us come to the apocalypse complete without splinter or stone. Let us ride out on four iron feet. I have to look and see what else turns up in that poem. Oh, yes. Here is the owl. The owl poem is called Insomnia. Sort of fitting. And it has a little epigraph. To hear the owl is the poet's prerogative. That little provocative statement was said to me by a young man who was visiting a daughter at the farm, and I remember coming down for breakfast and saying that I hadn't slept all night because the owls had been relentlessly hunting and hooting as they killed, and it had kept me awake all night. And he very respectfully said, and I thought it was a wonderful line, well, to hear the owl is the poet's prerogative. And so that's how the poem came to be. Insomnia. In the hand-me-down of dead hours, I hear him moving up the mountain, tree by tree, insistent as a paranoid, calling out his one verse, raising the breakbone alarm like those quaint East European churches that tolled their non-Sunday bells to usher in the pogrom. Finally, he settles in my basswood. We both doze, listening for each other. Going out to help my horse up in the first light, I see him hurry into the haymow, furtive as an old boarder, flapping along the corridor to tell his secret to the toilet. Oh, red eye, sit tight up in the rafters. Hang on, safe as a puffball. Tonight, another chapter, the promise of hatchets. Okay, I think that sort of explores what I was trying to say. The retrieval system has a whole section of poems that are built on dreams, and this is something I've been playing with a whole lot more in recent years. And commending it to my students, too, to keep track of, write down dream material, and then try to use it in poems. I don't think it works unless you're able to solve the dream in the process of writing the poem, which is to say you have to solve the puzzle that the dream proposes. So that maybe, every dream is clearly not going to give rise to a poem, but from time to time you get them. And this is one that was astonishing to me because as I wrote the poem, it became very clear what the dream content had been saying. Unfortunately, when I wrote this poem, it was long before Iran, and as an example of a tacky, unfamiliar town, I used Tehran. I guess I'm going to have to find a replacement for that, but I'll read it the way it was originally written. This poem is called My Father's Neckties. Last night, my colorblind, chain-smoking father, who has been dead for 14 years, stepped up out of a basement tie shop downtown and did not recognize me. The number he was wearing was as terrible as any from my girlhood, a time of ugly ties and acrimony. 6 or 7 blue lightning bolts outlined in yellow. Although this was my hometown, it was tacky and unfamiliar. It was Tehran or Gibraltar. Daddy smoking his habitual square-in-the-mouth cigarette and coughing ashes down the lightning jags. He was my age exactly. It was wordless, a window opening on an interior we both knew, where we had loved each other, keeping it quiet. Why do I wait years and years to dream this outcome? My brothers, in whose dreams he must as surely turn up, wearing repties or polka dots clumsily knotted, do not speak of their encounters. When we die, all four of us in whatever sequence, The designs will fall off like face masks, and the rayon ravel from this hazy version of a man who wore hard colors recklessly and hid out in the foreign bargain basements of his feelings. Thank you. Another poem which uses a dream, uses some dream material, is an elegy I wrote in 1974 when my very close friend, Anne Sexton, killed herself. Actually, I've written a series of poems over the years about her and even a recent one to her. This one is called Splitting Wood at Six Above. And it contains a whole, you know, those wishful dreams you have after you lose someone dear to you. It was a very simplistic dream. I dreamt she had called me on the phone, but couldn't reveal where she was calling from because she was calling from the other side, as she said. It was a wonderful, childish dream, I thought, and then the poem kind of came after. Splitting wood at six above. I open a tree. In the stupefying cold, ice on bare flesh a scald, I seat the metal wedge with a few left-handed swipes. Then, with a change of grips, lean into the 8-pound sledge. It's muslin overhead. Snow falls as heavy as salt. You are 4 months dead. The beech log comes apart like a chocolate nougat. The wood speaks, first in the tiny voice of a bird cry, a puppet squeak, and then all in a rush, all in a passionate stammer, the papery soul of the beech released by wedge and hammer flies back into air. Time will do this as fair to hickory, birch, black oak, easing the insects in till rot and freeze combine to raise out of wormwood cracks, blue and dainty, the souls. They are thin as an eyelash. They flap once, going up. The air rings like a bell. I breathe out drops, cold morning ghost puffs, like your old cigarette cough. See you tomorrow, you said. You lied. We're far from finished. I'm still talking to you. Last night's dream. We'll split the phone bill. It's expensive calling from the other side. Even waking, it seems logical. Your small, round, stubbornly airborne soul, that sun-yellow daisy heart slipping the noose of its pod, scooting over the tightrope, none the worse for its trip to arrive at the other side. It is the sound of your going. I drive into heartwood. I stack my quartered cuts, bark down, open yellow face up. Well, there are about 6 others of these poems, but recently I had the occasion to talk with the woman who Houghton Mifflin has signed a contract with to do a biography of Anne Sexton. And she was someone I liked immediately upon meeting her, and I think she's very bright and very honorable, and she'll do a very sort of non-sensational and good job of the biography. And after she left, so many things had been raised in my head that this poem started itself. And it's called Apostrophe to a Dead Friend on Being Interviewed by Her Biographer. Little by little, my gender drifts away, leaving the bones of this person whose shoe size was your size, who traded dresses in our pool of public occasion costumes, yours the formal length jersey, mine the cocktail wool, and your dead mother's mink coat that I always said looked like muskrat. It fades, the glint of those afternoons we lay in the sun by the pond, paler the intimate confidences, even the distances we leapt in poems have shrunk, no more parapets. The men have grown smaller, drier, easier to refuse. Passion subsides like a sunset. Urgency has been wrung from the rendezvous. Now that the children have changed into exacting adults, the warmth we felt for each other's young takes on the skin tone of plain daylight. However well-fed and rosy, they are no kinder or wiser than we. Soon I will be 60. How it was with you now, hardly more vivid than how it was without you. I carry the sheer weight of the telling like a large infant on one hip. I, who am remaindered in the conspiracy, doom, doom on my lips. It's the first time I've read that to an audience. Thank you. I said to a friend before this reading that one good thing about being far from home is that it gives you the courage to try out new poems. Somehow it's like, I guess, like taking a new show on the road. You know, you open in New Haven or Philadelphia or whatever before you go to Broadway. So that's one. Well, I guess I should back up a little and maybe read something else from Upcountry. There's a little lyric I'm still fond of, a little country lyric called Watering Trough, that I'll read. Let the end of all bathtubs be this putting out to pasture of four Victorian bow legs anchored in grasses. Let all long-necked browsers come drink from the shallows while faucets grow rusty and porcelain yellows. Where once our nude forebears soaped up in this vessel, come, cows, and come, horses, bring burdock and thistle. Come, slaver the scum of timothy and clover on the cast-iron lip that our grandsires climbed over. And let there be always green water for sipping, that muzzles may enter thoughtful and rise dripping. And here's a very watery poem. This is an early poem of mine, written in rhyming couplets, and goes back to a time in my life when I had ambitions about being a professional swimmer. And worked at summer camp and used to get up at Reveille and swim a mile before breakfast, you know. Oh, gone are the days. And it's just called Morning Swim. Into my empty head there come a cotton beach, a dock wherefrom I set out oily and nude through mist in chilly solitude. There was no line, no roof or floor to tell the water from the air. Night fog thick as terry cloth closed me in its fuzzy growth. I hung my bathrobe on two pegs. I took the lake between my legs. Invaded and invader, I went overhand on that flat sky. Fish twitched beneath me, quick and tame. In their green zone, they sang my name. And in the rhythm of the swim, I hummed a 2-4-time slow hymn. I hummed, abide with me. The beat rose in the fine thrash of my feet, rose in the bubbles I put out slantwise, trailing through my mouth. My bones drank water. Water fell through all my doors. I was the well that fed the lake that met my sea, in which I sang, abide with me. And then I might read another wet one. I spent about 6 weeks in 1973 as poet in residence in Danville, Kentucky. And out of that experience came a whole series of Kentucky poems. I'll just read, I think, probably just that one. In At Center College in Danville, Kentucky, they don't have a swimming pool. They have something called the Bowles Natatorium. It's quite splendid. And it was sort of a dreary, lonely time for me. I got a lot of writing done, which is what happens when you isolate poets. And every day I went and swam a mile in this beautiful pool. And whenever I came, if the team was practicing, the coach would blow his whistle and say, "Clear lane 6 for the poet," and they would all move over. It was really wonderful. The most striking thing about being in Danville, Kentucky, was being in hard-shell Baptist country, being the heart of the Pentecostal evangelical faiths. And I wrote a whole lot of Jesus poems about this experience. This is only very slightly, well, it is allusive, but it's not a real personal Jesus poem. Some of the others really are. This is called "To Swim to Believe." The beautiful excess of Jesus on the waters is with me now in the Bowles Natatorium. This bud of me exults, giving witness. These flippers that rose up to be arms, these strings drawn to be fingers, legs plumped to make my useful fork. Each time I tear this seam to enter, all that I carry is taken from me, shucked in the dive. Lovers, children, even words go under. Matters of dogma spin off in the freestyle, earning that mid-pool spurt like faith. Where have I come from? Where am I going? What do I translate, gliding back and forth, erasing my own stitch marks in this lane? Christ on the lake was not thinking where the next heel toe went. God did him a dangerous favor, whereas Peter, the thinker, sank. The secret is in the relenting, the partnership. I let my body work, accepting the dangerous favor from this king-sized pool of waters. Together I am supplicant, I am bride. And now that we're sort of into body poems, I thought, since this we're well past the midpoint of this reading, I thought I might read an audience participation poem, which is called "Song for 7 Parts of the Body." It's a riddle poem, and you're supposed to guess the answers to the riddles. Song for 7 parts of the body. I have not planted the answer to the first riddle, which I usually do, because I'm nervous that everyone will be quiet. But this audience is so responsive, I don't think I have to read. 1. This one, a common type, turns in, was once attached, fed me as sweetly as an opium pipe. Oh, birthdays unlimber us, eyes sit back, ears go indoors, but here nothing changes. This was, this is. Very good. Belly button. Stanley Kunitz said to me, that one is hard because mine turns out. So you see. All right. 2. Mostly they lie low, put up shells, sprout hairs, and if they sing, they know only leather cares. Blind marchers 5 abreast, left, right, silent as mushrooms or puff paste, they rise up free at night. Toes. Very good. Toes. Okay. 3. I have a life of my own, he says. He is transformed without benefit of bone. I will burrow, he says, and enters. Afterwards, he goes slack as a slug. He remembers little. The prince is again a frog. Four. That seems to be self-explanatory. 4. Here is a field that never lies fallow. Sweat waters it. Nails hoe the roots. Every day death comes in with the winnow. Every day newborns crop up like asparagus. At night, all night on the pillow, you can hear the narrow sprouts crackle, rubbing against each other, lying closer than lemmings. They speak to their outposts in armpits. They speak to their settlers in crotches. Neighbor, neighbor, they murmur. Yeah, hair, that's right. Okay, five. They have eyes that see not. They straddle the valley of wishes. Their hills make their own rules. Among them are bobbers, melons, fishes, doorknobs, and spools. At times they whisper, touch me. Yeah, breast. Six. Imagine a mouth without you, pink man, good fellow. A house without a kitchen, a fishless ocean, no way to swallow. Tom, yeah. And seven, the last one. These nubbins, these hangers-on, hear not. Wise men tug them in thought. Lovers may nibble each other's. Maidens, gypsies, and peasants make holes in theirs to hang presents. Yeah, earlobes, yeah. Very good, you were very good. And this will be a very different poem. This is a political poem. When I wrote this poem, I was teaching at a small liberal arts college, a little Catholic college for women. And I remember one of my students came up to me with tears in her eyes and said after I read it, "Poor God, everybody puts everything onto him." So I suppose that's true. This poem is called Heaven as Anus. Well, wait till you hear it. In the Defense Department, there is a shop where scientists sew the eyelids of rabbits open, lest they blink in the scorch of a nuclear drop. And elsewhere, dolphins are being taught to defuse bombs in the mock-up of a harbor, and monkeys learn to perform the simple tasks of draftees. It is done with electric shocks. Some mice who have failed their time tests in the maze now go to the wire unbidden for their jolts. Implanting electrodes yields rich results. Alley cats turn from predators into prey. Show them a sparrow and they cower, while the white wall labs fill up with the feces of fear, where calves whose hearts have been done away with walk and bleat on plastic pumps. And what is any of this to the Godhead, these squeals, whines, writhings, unexpected jumps, whose children burn alive, booby-trap the dead, lop ears and testicles, core and disembowel? It all ends at the hole. No words may enter the house of excrement. We will meet there as the sphincter of the good Lord opens wide and he takes us all inside. All right, I'm going to read a semi-occasional poem. This, I suppose, is also slightly political. It's interesting to let one poem just reverberate in your head and, you know, make you think of another. And here's a later poem called Remembering Pearl Harbor at the Tutankhamun exhibit. I don't know how many of you got to see that Egyptian, the Tutankhamun exhibit, but this is the one time that being on a committee had a, you know, a perk that went with it. I was on the National Endowment literature panel for a while, and because we worked so honorably and hard and without reward, they put us in at the front of the line, and we got to see the whole Tutankhamun exhibit. And it was a very strange experience, as you will now hear. This poem is called Remembering Pearl Harbor at the Tutankhamun exhibit. Wearing the beard of divinity, King Tut hunts the hippopotamus of evil. He cruises the netherworld on the back of a black leopard. and here he has put on his special pectoral, the one painted with granulated gold. This will adorn him as he crosses over. I shuffle in line on December 7th to see how that royal departure took place. A cast of thousands is passing this way. No one looks up from the alabaster as jets crisscross overhead. Our breaths cloud the cases that lock in the gold and lapis lazuli. The day of infamy, Roosevelt called it. I was a young girl listening to the radio on a Sunday of hard weather. Probably not one in seven packed in these rooms goes back there with me. Implicit throughout this exhibit, arranged by Nixon and Sadat as heads of state, is an adamantine faith in total resurrection. Therefore, the king is conveyed with a case for his heart and another magnificent hinged apparatus far too small for his intestines, all in place, all considered retrievable. Whereas, if one is to be blown apart over land or water, back into the nothingness that precedes light, it is better to go with the simplest detail, a cross, a dog tag, a clamshell. I'm going to read a vegetable poem, and it's called The Survival Poem, and it has an epigraph from a Canadian novelist named Mavis Gallant. Maybe you know her work. She lives in France, but she is Canadian, and she says in a novel called A Fairly Good Time, I saw a picture of a market stall in the morning paper, and under the picture was written, the dreaded rutabaga has again made its appearance. When people talk to me about the occupation of Paris, they mention the dreaded rutabaga. I guess I should say, in case you don't know this, and you probably wouldn't know this living in a climate where you grow crops year-round, the rutabaga is it's a sort of an enormous, smelly turnip, and they're grown in the Midwest, they're grown in the Northeast. In the Midwest, they're called Swedes, because in Minnesota, it was the Swedes who introduced them. And in England, they simply call them roots. I don't know why, but they're always talking about how roots are good for you, you know, to eat. The survival poem. Welcome, old Swede, old baggy root, old bind rag as well of Bonaparte's troops. When the horse's nostrils are webbed with ice and out of the hay fall torpid mice and calves go stiff in their mother's wombs and the apple core cloaks the tunnel worm. When the soldier's bandages hung out to dry clatter like boards in the 4 o'clock sky and the last blood runs from the bulbs of the beets and the cabbages shed their 100 sheets, welcome, old Swede, strong-smelling Bigfoot. In the camps, all ate from the same rank pot. Let me dine with praise on you alone. Pray the Lord lay me down one more time like a stone. One winter more from my musty bed. Pray the Lord raise me up in the morn like bread. Now, I'll just read a couple more, and I'd like to read a couple of, I think, new things. Here's a little tiny vegetable poem in a different voice. It's called In the Pea Patch. These, as they clack in the wind, saying castanets, saying dance with me, saying do me, dangle their intricate, nuggety scrota. And these, with the light shining through, call up a woman in a gauzy dress, young, with tendrils of hair at her neck, leaning in a summer doorway. And as the bloom of the lime-green pod rubs away under the polishing thumb, in the interior, sweet for the taking, 9 little fetuses nod their cloned heads. And I'm going in the wrong direction. Here's one more horse poem. This is a poem about jumping. It's called Never. It's really a metaphor. It can be anything. Good for you, he calls beside me as I take the chicken coop, the in and out, the double oxer, all without sucking back, springing off my hocks as if at Ledyard, an Olympic champ. Down the mudslide I whirl, clearing the drop jump, the one my heart lurches over, clinging to my soft palate where it thumps like a snared rabbit. Oh, heart, we are a pair of good girls hurtling the ditch at the bottom of the chute, and up the other side, good for you, victorious, not over fear, my lifelong boarder, morose skulker about the house, but over time. The large child inside leaps up for daddy's loud kiss, for daddy's lollipop. Body on body riding hard, good for you. I play to spin this game out to the end, never coming to the part where we stop, where the jumps are set too high and darkness wins. And you may have noticed that the poems get darker and darker as the poets get older and older. Here's a poem called The Poets Observe the Absence of God from the St. Louis Zoo. I wrote it for my friend Howard Nemiroff. I was at Washington University in St. Louis for a while, and we did go to the zoo, and it seemed to suggest this. I wrote it about a year after the fact. That's what Wordsworth said, emotion recollected in tranquility. The poets observe the absence of God from the St. Louis Zoo. November, that time of year the Lord created and forgot, the big cats lurk diminished in the mouths of their man-made caves. Most of the pink has been bleached from the huddled flamingos. The camels squat over the nest of their folded legs. To this place, the aging poets, old friends, neither quite dressed for the morning chill, come flailing their arms in thin sunlight. They stroll through the kingdom of roars and smells. They shelter in the murk of the aquarium, peer into the mouths of ancient sea turtles, follow the bursts of minute tropical fish, but do not raise the eternal questions. Is utility the one criterion for creation? Does form follow function? Neither chooses to cite the neck of the giraffe, the rhinoceros's horn. Nothing is said of the opposable thumb, by means of which, in the next pen, a muscular attendant in sou'wester and boots force-feeds dead fish to the penguins, cramming the smelts headfirst like grain being tamped down the craw of a Strasbourg goose. O deus absconditus, the tamed formal birds, glutted for the day, and balancing without shoulders, waddle about their confines. Each of the poets notes how helpless the natty creatures look, how that in itself is pathetic fallacy. They move on, arms wrapped round each other's backs. Both are writing this poem in their heads, in a tight-lipped month between extreme weathers, while their lives speed by like outbound traffic. And I think maybe it's getting on. I think I'll just read one little one to close on. If you fly a lot, you'll recognize the title of this poem. It's called Our ground time here will be brief. It's going to be the title of an upcoming collection of poems in late spring of 82. Our ground time here will be brief. Blue landing lights make nail holes in the dark. A fine snow falls. We sit on the tarmac taking on the mail, quick freight, trays of laboratory mice, coffee and Danish for the passengers. Wherever we're going is Monday morning. Wherever we're coming from is Mother's lap. On the cloud pack above, strewn as loosely as parsnip or celery seeds, lie the souls of the unborn, my children's children's children, and their father. We gather speed for the last run and lift off into the weather. Thank you.